it's recording now.
Thank you, Rabbi Karsh, Rabbi Charlie Katz. It's a pleasure to be here again. In a way, the topic that I was asked to address is a very, very painful and difficult and emotionally taxing issue, the issue of Ahavas Yisrael, love that we have for a fellow Jew. All of us know that we live in a Jewish society that is superheated, that is polarized, that is divisive, both here and in the land of Israel. And we ask ourselves, what can we do practically to try to improve the situation and to try to build bridges and use our religion and use our Torah and use our tradition to open doors and to make connections instead of using it to close doors and to sever them and to burn bridges. I'd like to address the matter by really connecting it to the upcoming holiday that we're going to be celebrating in a few days, the holiday of Shavuos. Shavuos, at least among people who are not very observant, is one of the lesser known holidays. I remember after my first year of law school and I applied for a summer job, and I'm from Hartford, Connecticut, so I worked in the law department of the Aetna Life Insurance Company. So I informed my boss shortly after I was hired that I would have to take off 2 days because of the upcoming holiday of Shavuos. So my supervisor came back around 45 minutes later saying, you know, I'm sorry, I checked with every Jewish lawyer in the firm, and they heard of Passover and Sukkot even, but no one ever heard of Shavuos. Could I submit some verification that such a Jewish holiday exists? So indeed, Shavuos is not always the best known of our holidays. However, Shavuos, and the preparation for Shavuos, has some very important lessons regarding the notion of Ahavas Yisrael. We know that the countdown, as we just said, the countdown towards, or the count up, towards the holiday of Shavuos is a period of time between Pesach and Shavuos that is called the counting of the Omer. Every single day we say, this is the first day of the Omer, the second day of the Omer, the third day of the Omer was a barley offering that was brought the second day of Pesach. And if we ask ourselves, what is the purpose of this period called counting of the Omer? And what is it that we are supposed to think about? There are actually two distinct themes that emerge in the course of the counting of the Omer, which to some degree operate at cross purposes, but are ultimately converged and become one. Theme number one is, the counting of the Omer is a linkage between the holiday of Pesach and the holiday of Shavuos. In fact, one can look at the counting of the Omer as the Chol Hamoed, kind of the weekdays in between a single indivisible holiday, starting from Pesach and ending with Shavuos. Why do we have such a linkage? Because Pesach represents freedom, liberation, redemption from oppression. Shavuos represents discipline, submission, and commitment to the will of God. The linkage reminds us that freedom has significance only when it is combined with a submission to the will of Hashem, only when it is also coupled with Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim, acceptance of the over heaven, that freedom is not an end, but freedom must be a means. As Eric Fromm used to say, freedom must be defined not as freedom from something, but freedom towards something. And when the freedom is not linked with the freedom towards something, it results in the kind of discontent and the aching hearts that we see so much in our culture, a culture which is materially affluent, but in which we see, even among teenagers from upper and other middle-class homes, a sense of aimlessness, a sense of despair. And it is no accident that the teenage suicide rate is so high in this country, because when material wants are addressed, but meaning and purpose are not given, the human heart aches because of that void. Freedom is not enough unless it is linked to purpose and meaning. Our Chachamim made this point. They point out in the fact that the Korban, the offering of Pesach, was an offering of barley, which is animal fodder, and the Korban of Shavuos is a Korban of wheat bread, which is human food. And the transition from Pesach to Shavuos, freedom to submission, is the transition from animal liberation to human dignity. In fact, Tagore, an Indian poet who won the Nobel Prize for literature shortly after World War I, said it very, very beautifully. He compared a human soul to a violin string. Ironically, if the string is totally loose, if it has no moorings, if it's not stretched, it cannot express the music that is within. It is only when it is stretched twice that the true music that is within that string is able to emerge. So on one level, the types of things we think about during the counting of the Omer is how to give our freedom meaning and purpose. To recognize that human beings, and Jews in particular, have to have meaning. As Viktor Frankl writes in his classic work, Man's Search for Meaning, which he indeed identifies the search for meaning as the central need and quest of the human soul. He says, when a human being has a why, they can bear almost any wants. This can take us through the difficulties and adversities of life if we have that sense of purpose. So theme number one of the Omer would obviously call upon us to become religiously more intense, to increase our commitment to the study of the Torah, the doing of the mitzvahs, to prayer, to good deeds. And that, of course, is certainly how we prepare for the receiving of the Torah and Shavuot. But there is a theme number two of Sfiras HaOmer, which leads into my main remarks. And that is, one would have thought that the counting of the Omer period should be joyous and exciting, as we are looking forward to re-experiencing the revelation at Mount Sinai. And yet we also know that in the Jewish tradition, the days of the Omer are tinged with a certain degree of sadness and mourning. And we are told this is so because many, many years after the Decalogue at Sinai, Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students. And these 24,000 students died during the period of the Omer. And the reason they died, the Talmud states, Shalom na'adu kavod zelazeh. They did not show proper honor and respect to each other. And they died. And we mourn their deaths to this very day by not making weddings, for example, not getting haircuts, not listening to music. But what is going on? First of all, unfortunately, we have tragedies far exceeding 24,000 people dying. We have 6 million Jews who died in this century alone. Why are we so concerned about the students of Rabbi Akiva? And what does the Gemara mean? They didn't show proper respect to each other. Do we assume that Rabbi Akiva's students, who were great rabbis and scholars, they slammed the door against each other? They spoke rudely to each other? Is that the assumption? I would assume not, because, after all, normal people, as it were, don't behave rudely towards each other. Why would the students of Rabbi Akiva behave that way? To fully understand this concept of not showing kavod for each other, there are really two things I want to take you through. One is, what is the meaning of the word kavod? And second of all, let's analyze Rabbi Akiva in terms of his life and what his students learned or failed to learn. The word kavod, we translate as honor, respect. But Rav Shushner Paul Hirsch offers a very fascinating etymology. And he says the etymology of kavod is the same as kaved. Kaved is heavy, significant, weighty. Something is heavy, it's called kaved. So kavod does not refer to etiquette or politeness. It refers to looking at another human being and seeing that other human being as being weighty, as being significant, as having something to offer the world and to offer you. Somebody who counts, somebody who matters, someone who is a beloved child of God, because indeed every human being, Jew or non-Jew, it says in Pirkei Avos, Chaviv Adam, Shenivra B'Tselem, beloved is every human being, for every human being was created in the image of God. So when we say one does not show proper kavod to another human being, we don't mean they slam the door, or we don't mean they push them aside in line. They could be, in fact, it could be, as far as the external observer could see, everything was fine. But in the depths of their hearts, they looked at each other a bit askance, a sense of disdain, a sense that the other person doesn't really count that much. The other person has nothing to teach me, because I am in possession of the truth. I know what is right. And that person, there's nothing I can learn from that person. That is what it means to say, lo na'adu kavod zelo zel. It's an attitude. It is not a behavior necessarily. It refers to the way one looks at their fellow human being. With a sense of love, with a sense of respect, with a sense of the significance of the other, or with a sense of disparagement and what we call beetle modification. It is very paradoxical that our Chachamim found that this flaw existed in the disciples of Rabbi Akiva. Because let's look a little bit at Rabbi Akiva's life. Rabbinic literature is not predominantly a romantic genre. There are very few romance stories in rabbinic literature. But the only one that indeed does appear is the life of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was born into a family which was descended from converts. He was not given any Jewish education. In fact, he was not given any education at all. He was illiterate. He grew up. He became a shepherd. He tended animals. He eventually received employment in a very, very wealthy and influential family in the outskirts of Yerushalayim, a family of a man called Kalba Sabua. Kalba Sabua actually means a bulldog. The Chazal said this was a nickname that he was given because he was so generous with his guests that if they walked in hungry, they could eat as much as a dog would eat, one amount of food, and they would walk away satisfied. And he's simply a shepherd, probably one of many shepherds. And lo and behold, the boss's daughter, her name was Rachel, was attracted to Rabbi Akiva in various ways. She wanted to marry him. Her father was aghast. Number one, Akiva was an ignorant shepherd. Number two, he was poor. What does it look like in terms of social relationships? And in a peak of anger, he excommunicated her, and he made a vow that she would not have any of his property upon his death. And she married Rabbi Akiva. She lived in poverty, but she saw in Rabbi Akiva certain qualities. She saw his honesty. She saw his integrity. She saw his intelligence. And the Gemara tells us that she urged him to go and study Torah and make something of himself. And he went to study Torah in Yerushalayim. He started, he was already at the age of 40 when he got married. He started learning Torah with the first graders. Imagine a 40-year-old person having to learn how to read together with small children. And she encouraged him to study and to learn. And in fact, he was gone for 12 years. After 12 years, he came home to her, and he overheard her conversing with the neighbors, or one of the neighbors made fun of her and said, "What type of husband do you have who's left you for 12 years?" And she said, "I wouldn't mind if you go for another 12 years," which was said in a positive way, interested in being would study the Torah. And according to the tradition, he didn't even say hello. He went back right away. At the end of the 24 years that he was gone, he was no longer the ignorant shepherd. He was the great Rabbi Akiva, the greatest of the sages of Israel. And he came back with 24,000 people. During those years, she lived in poverty, she lived in deprivation. She lived without a husband, but it was working because she produced a Rabbi Akiva and all of the students. And those were the 24 studies. Back to the Gemara Gavana says that as they approached, she came out to meet Rabbi Akiva. The students didn't know who she was. They pushed her away. And Rabbi Akiva said, no. Shali v'shalachem. What I have achieved and what you have achieved is shalach. It is only yours. Without her, there would have been nothing at all. Imagine how a woman in particular feels when there's been so much sacrifice and so much loss and so much effort, but finally she sees what it is that they produce with their lives, Rabbi Akiva's devotion and her sacrifice, and what that produced. And those were the 24,000 students. In a short time thereafter, they're totally destroyed. Or like that. Think about the myth of Sisyphus, the person in Greek mythology, who is condemned to roll the rock up the top of the mountain. And when he finally gets there, all that happens is it goes down again. And the guy starts from point zero. Imagine how devastating this impact was. And yet, these were the students that Rabbi Akiva that died. Their life's work was apparently destroyed. But what's interesting is that we know that Rabbi Akiva taught the Ahavta L'Rayacha Kamocha, loving your friend as you love yourself. This is a verse in Leviticus in Vayikra. Zeh klal gadol b'Torah. This is a fundamental rule of the Torah. The fundamental principle of the Torah is to love a fellow Jew as you love yourself. Now it's true that kavod and love are not the same thing. But if we define kavod as seeing the importance of another human being, seeing their significance. It's very, very clear there can be no love unless there is kavod. If I love my spouse, but I don't respect my spouse, then my love is nothing more than self-gratification and using someone for my own selfish needs. Love is predicated on kavod. So the tremendous paradox that we have here is, on one hand, we have Rabbi Akiva's lifelong teaching, the Ahavtal Reyecha Kamocha, loving another person, another Jew, is the cardinal principle of the Torah. And that love presupposes kavod. And this was his teaching over and over and over again. And yet, the students died because they did not show that element of kavod. Perhaps if you permit me to be a little biographical or engage in psychological speculation, it might be suggested that why did Rabbi Akiva see that the Ahavta L'Reyecha Kamocha was the most important klal in the entire Torah? Because he saw in his own life the transformative effect that loving and respecting a human being could have. He saw that it was only because Rachel, his spouse, saw in him qualities of goodness and qualities of intelligence and qualities of strength that he was not even aware that he possessed himself, that those qualities became evident. The qualities that we see within another human being become self-fulfilling realities, whether it's the way we view our children or the way we view our spouses, or the way we view our students if we are teachers. What we see is literally what we get. If we choose to see the negative, if we choose to see the flaws, if we choose to see all of the different things that are wrong within a person, then those wrongs and those defects become magnified and strengthened and increased. If we choose to see our fellow human being as a beloved child of God, as indeed they are, then indeed the qualities within them that are good and noble will become magnified and will become exemplified. This is why Rabbi Akiva saw in the Ahavta L'Reyecha Kamocha that it's a klal gadol, it's a great fundamental principle, not just in terms of loving another person, but in terms of bringing them close to God as well. Because what we see in that other person are the qualities that will eventually become manifested and actualized in reality. And yet it is a paradox, but perhaps it's not a paradox. Perhaps it's precisely because they were the students of Rabbi Akiva that God expected them to internalize this notion more so than anyone else. And perhaps the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva were no worse than anybody else. And maybe they were better than most. But they did not live up to the standard that they should have absorbed from their Rebbe himself. So this is the second aspect that we think about during the counting of the Omer, and that is how to generate a sense of love and kavod and respect for our fellowship. If we stand back and we look at these two separate ideas of the counting of the Omer, one is the linkage between Pesach and Shavuos, which is the concept of linking freedom and commitment. And the second aspect of looking at our fellow Jew with respect and with love, we see that to some degree they almost contradict. We can look around at the world that we live in, and we see many passionate, fervor, religiously enthusiastic people. But how often is it the case that somehow religious enthusiasm and strictness somehow translate into disdain and either perhaps not necessarily open hatred, but a notion of disparagement of others who don't share that same magnitude of religious commitment? And then on the other end of the extreme, we have Jews who are perhaps exemplary in their love and their tolerance of all. But if everything becomes, I'm okay, you're okay, and there's a sense of moral relativism, and every single idea out there is totally acceptable because there is nothing that is better than anything else, then it's easy to be accepting and tolerant and loving when one does not stand for any matter of principle whatsoever. So, one can find the Jew that is totally immersed in the concepts of submission to the will of God, and one can find Jews who are lax in their religious commitments, but are open and tolerant and accepting. But is it indeed possible to have commitments without intolerance? Is it possible to have passion without polarization? Is it possible to have fervor without disparagement? These are very, very difficult issues. And this is what the counting of the Omer calls upon us to try to integrate in our own lives as we approach Shavuos. To be able to look at another Jew, whether that Jew is as observant as I, and perhaps that's not even the right way of saying it. I remember years ago giving a shiur somewhere in Maryland, and a woman approached me after the shiur, and she prefaced her remarks by saying, "I am not as religious as you, but..." And I interrupted her at the beginning of her sentence, and I said, "How do you know you are not as religious as me? Maybe you are more religious than I am. I perhaps keep Shabbos more than you do. I may know a bit more. But perhaps you're a better parent. You're a better spouse. You're a better child. The Torah has many, many mitzvahs. And to divide the world into those who keep the mitzvahs versus the other, in effect, takes away the legitimacy and the goodness and the holiness of the other." You know, and I'm sure Rabbi Karsh and all the work in the field of Jewish outreach would agree with me. The model of outreach is not the concept that somehow the religious are standing at a pedestal and they are looking down at the poor, unfortunate, worthless souls down there and we lift them up. The concept truly is one of mutual sharing, of mutual outreach. That if there are things that rabbis can teach others, there are certainly many, many things that others teach rabbis as well. With people's sacrifice and the struggles that people go through to try to serve God. And we know that above all, what God considers most important in a human life is the struggle to serve Him. And sometimes that struggle will not yield total and immediate success. But it is the struggle and it is the process that is noble. And looking at another human being with kavod sees that we recognize the legitimacy of struggle. We recognize that people are grappling with issues. We recognize that people are seeking a way to connect to their heritage and to God. And we applaud that, and we respect it, and we acknowledge it. And we consider it to be weighty and significant. And in that sense, even people who come out in different ways, and even people who don't agree, even on very, very significant issues, can at least look at the other with a sense of kavod, a sense of dignity, a sense of respect, but not a respect that is born out of a moral indifference and a moral relativism, but a respect that comes out of the passion to do the will of God. You know, there's a striking statement in a Medrash, where the Medrash tells us that God speaks to Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi is speaking to somebody. And Eliyahu HaNavi quotes God by saying, "There are two things that I love. Shnei devorim ani ohei, the ahava gemura. There are two things that I love with a complete and total love. And I don't know which one I love more. And this is the Torah and the Jewish people." So the Eliyahu HaNavi then pressed God to say, "Okay, which one do you love more?" He said, "You love them, but no." Like Charles Dickens writes about David Copperfield, I remember reading when I was in grammar school, that every parent secretly has their favorite child, but they never said who it is. So God says, "These are the two things I love total." Well, Eliyahu HaNavi said, "Which do you love more?" And Hashem said, "I don't really want to answer, but it's the Jewish people, even more." This is actually a medrash in time of the Bel Gadol, that this is how God loves you, even more. You know, if we ask ourselves, so how do you do this? You know, it's funny, I once had the occasion in Baltimore years and years ago, this is before I had the job of having to talk on the Shabbos before Rosh Hashanah, I used to go to other shows and listen to Rabbi Spock and his stories. But I walked into a very, very fervently Orthodox, what you call a black hat show, of people who are very, very committed. And the rabbi gave a sermon about the importance of keeping Shabbos. And then I walked into a much more modern, progressive synagogue, and the rabbi talked about the idea of loving your fellow Jew and loving him. And I thought to myself, you know, it would have been the most tremendous thing in the world had the two sermons been reversed. Because the one that was talking about keeping Shabbos, everybody in the show kept Shabbos meticulously. And the other show was a very welcoming, friendly place, but they could use a little more discipline in keeping Shabbos. Two very wonderful drashos. But sometimes we're speaking to the converted. Each side walks away. In other words, when you walk away from a talk, although all rabbis, this is an occupational hazard, we sometimes play to the audience, but really, when you walk away from a talk, people shouldn't walk away thinking, that's great, I'm doing the right thing and there's some fault in the other people. In one show, people walk away and they say, yeah, that's right, we keep Shabbos, we're wonderful. And in the other place they walk away, we welcome people, we're wonderful. The challenge is to combine both. And it's very, very difficult. But the truth of the matter is, if you go back to Jewish history, we commonly talk about Avraham Avinu being the first Jew, whatever that means, although it's not a very precise term. Look at Avraham Avinu himself. Avraham Avinu, on one hand, is called Avraham or Ivri. Avraham the Hebrew. Ivri means Abraham Ahar, coming from the other side of the river, because our ancestral location is east of the Euphrates River. But Chazal say the other meaning of Eber is he was a person who had such convictions that he could stand on one side of the river even if the entire world stood on the other side. He did not yield to peer pressure. He preached and he taught belief in God in a very uncompromising, undiluted way. The epitome of passion and fervor and moral courage. But that same Avraham Avinu, who is the true believer, the zealot, as it were, is the Avraham Avinu whose tent was open to even the idolater, who prayed for the degenerate populations of Sodom, who really didn't deserve to live, but Avraham bargains with God, give them a chance, give them a chance, save the city for this amount of people and this amount of people. So you see that it is possible to be the Avraham or Ivri and at the same time pray for the people of Sodom. The truth of the matter is that Jews should not be good haters. There are times in which we have to stand up. There are times in which we have to proclaim what the Torah requires us to do. But it should be done with a great deal of sadness. And it should be done out of love and concern and care for the significance of the other. For the significance of the other. There's a very good mashal, I think it is said in the name of Crime Salvation. You talk about the notion of being a true zealot, because we're the zealot, etc. And sometimes we see many, many people in our world who purport to be zealots, coming out with proclamations and statements against this or that. Rav Chaim once said, what is the difference between a true zealot and a false zealot? He compared it to a housewife who buys a cat to kill the mice in the home. The housewife and the cat share a common interest. Both hope that if there are mice, the cat will catch them and tear them apart. The difference is, the housewife desperately hopes there won't be any mice in the home at all. The cat looks for the mice so it can rip them apart. A true zealot gets no joy in exposing shortcomings and flaws. A true zealot acts out of love and concern for the Jewish people. It is the false zealot, the one who much prefers to expose the shortcomings of others, to looking into their own heart and soul and seeing what they can do to make this world a better place, that is so destructive for the Jewish people. Do you cry when you see Jews who are not keeping the Shabbos or our traditions? Or do you throw stones and laugh when you look at, you know, how bad those people are? That is the difference. So the dichotomy that I'm positing here is not a dichotomy that requires a person to be indifferent, but it's the opposite. That we try and we strive to expose people to the beauties of Judaism, but we do so with a sense of respect, a sense of kavod, and a sense of love. Because that is the only way one can ever reach. No human being either wants to or deserves to be disparaged or demeaned. And it is only by the recognition of the divine quality within their souls that they will ultimately find their way and find their dimension back to God. Let me just mention that, you know, there's a famous statement in the Gemara where the non-Jew, remember the non-Jew asked, Shammai, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. And Shammai chased him out. Shammai said, you know, don't fool around with me. And then he went to Hillel, and Hillel gave him the famous statement, what is hateful to you, do not do to others, the so-called golden rule. And Christianity has a lot of fun with that passage in the Talmud, because they point out that New Testament morality is superior to rabbinic, Pharisaic morality, because Hillel just used the negative. What is hateful to you, do not do to others, while Jesus used the positive notion of loving another person as you love yourself. The problem with that, of course, is, as I indicated before, the ahavta l'reyecha kamocha, loving another person in a positive way, is in the Torah itself. And Sefer HaYitra, precious Kedoshim. So the question is, indeed, it's an interesting question. Why does Hillel use the negative, don't hurt, as opposed to the higher level of giving and helping and raising someone? Why does he use the negative if indeed biblical morality compels the higher level of positive love, not just negative? And I think that there are two psychological insights that Hillel might be teaching us here. Indeed, the highest level is to be benevolent in behavior, to actually do acts of love and not just withdraw. But one lesson Hillel might be teaching us is the concept of gradualism in the service of God. You know, we live in a society of instant gratification. We want everything to happen right away. You know, I remember in the olden days, when we use snail mail, it might take 2 days to get a letter from here to New York. Now that we have email or fax, I know that I got a fax machine a few years ago, and if it takes 30 seconds to get a letter from here to China, you know, I'm drumming my fingers on the table. 30 seconds? Why is it taking so long? You know, the whole concept of waiting over a long period of time has become lost in our culture. If the phone breaks, we don't get it fixed. We throw it out and get another phone. If the marriage breaks, we tend to do the same thing. And sometimes, God forbid, if the fetus breaks, we do the same thing. We live in a throwaway society in which the concept of working and struggling has become very, very foreign to us. We want instant gratification. Well, the funny thing is, we want instant gratification in spiritual life as well. We want the quick fix. Rabbi Sosa Solandra used to say, if you'd ask every Jew, would you like to master the whole Talmud? We would say, sure. We wouldn't want to know the whole Talmud. Then we would say, people don't only want to know the whole Talmud, they want to know the whole Talmud in one night. Well, it is possible to know the whole Talmud. It's difficult, but theoretically possible, to master the Talmud in one night. But then he says it's a third level. People want to master the whole Talmud one night and sleep 8 hours that same night. That, he says, for sure, you're not going to be able to do. Even the Vilna Gaon needed the whole night to finish. He couldn't do it getting 8 hours of sleep that same night. Well, perhaps Hillel was teaching us, you want to start to learn to love other people. The first lesson is, learn how not to hurt them first. You know, you progress gradually. Learn, as it were, what hurts them, what affects them. Learn how to step back. Gradually work yourself into things, and don't assume you can achieve the highest levels right away. But there is a deeper message in Hill's use of the negative as well. It's not just the concept of gradualism, it's a general approach in spiritual life as well. Not to do too much too fast, but to understand what you're doing in a reasoned, progressive way. But the second insight is this. The first step in loving someone is to step back. Because far too often, we look at other people as simply opportunities for us to get brownie points in our relationship to God. Another niche on the belt. Another success for an outreach program or a yeshiva or a kollel or whatever it is. Not hurting requires that you step back. You withdraw. You look at the other person. You see them as a significant other. You see them as a distinct human being. And then you are ready to love and to help them. But Hillel's secret is, the first stage of love is indeed a certain distancing. It is the distancing of seeing that person as an autonomous entity with their own desires, their own needs, their own perspectives, their own creativity, their own contributions. And when you see them for what they are, you can then help them, love them, befriend them. This is very true in a marriage as well. That the first step towards the union of marriage is the stepping back. Indeed, that's why Chazal say that the original creation of Adam and Eve were one, but God then separated them, and then they come together. That there has to be the individuation of each in order for there to be a true loving relationship that comes together. And that is why Hillel uses the negative. Because far too often, we define what is good for a person by what we say is good, by what we say is right. We superimpose our desires, our definitions of good, onto the other, without ever stepping back and seeing them as a human being. And therefore, there's a great psychological insight in Hillel's use of the negative. Because the negative is not hurting, is the precursor of the ability to show love and benevolence. You know, I once read kind of a parody about, let's imagine 42nd Street in New York. Now, ever since Mayor Giuliani's 42nd Street has actually become a much safer neighborhood than it used to be, much cleaner, both spiritually and physically, cleaner neighborhood than it was. But imagine what would happen today if some great rabbi would go to 42nd Street at a time when it was very degenerate and start praying on behalf of the evildoers of 42nd Street, bringing them to repentance or urging them to repent, but also praying to God to have mercy and not destroy them because of their sins. One could imagine that had Avraham Avinu been alive today, perhaps that's what Avraham Avinu would have done. And one can also imagine the write-up in the various Jewish papers that might say, well, Avraham Avinu was certainly a righteous person and a good person, but perhaps he's a bit misguided in his love for these people who are undeserving. And that is what Avraham Avinu did to the people of Sodom. And I think that is what Avraham Avinu would have done even to the people at 42nd Street. And if we find this bizarre, and if we find it strange, and if we find it something that we would be critical of, perhaps it is yet another sign how far we have become removed from the vision that the Torah wants us to have of how we care and are concerned about our fellow Jew, about our fellow human being generally. So the concept of tolerance, acceptance, love, combined with commitment, passion, and religious fervor, are difficult to coexist within the same human being. And yet, our connection to Avraham Avinu requires that we try to internalize that. I'm not sure what time we're talking about. Yes, let me just finish up again. There's a lot more to talk about, because there's a lot more that needs to be said. And then again, I certainly do not mean to communicate that I am a paragon of virtue in this, as the Bali Mitzvah often say. And in this case, it's absolutely true. My remarks are much more directed to me than they are to the audience, but people are welcome to listen as I talk to myself. Franz Rosenzweig the famous Jewish German philosopher of the 1920s. He wrote The Star of Redemption. He, together with Martin Buber, produced a very, very well-accepted German translation of the Bible. Towards the end of his life, he was stricken with a serious neurological disease. I believe it was multiple sclerosis. He had paralysis, gradual paralysis in his body. And towards the end of his life, in Germany, which was largely a non-religious country, but he began to gravitate towards Jewish tradition more and more. And he was asked, towards the end of his life, whether he put on tefillin, the phylacteries that are worn every day. And his response was not a yes, nor was his response a no. His response was not yet. Not yet. Now, not yet is a wonderful statement. Because not yet basically says, I recognize that my life is not a finished book. I recognize that I am on a journey. I am on a voyage. I have not yet arrived. Not yet can be the rallying point and the unity and the point of contact that all Jews can have. Because every Jew has a not yet in their lives. Some, it might be Shabbos is not yet, Kashrus is not yet. For the most religious, it might be, not yet, I have not yet conquered Lashon Hara or disparaging other Jews. The not yet is the recognition that none of us are perfect. All of us have a road that we must travel, and that God cares much more about the fact that we are traveling the road than whatever particular point we have arrived on. Not yet is a statement that opens doors and doesn't close them, and not yet allows each of us to have a bridge and a connection with each other. Because anyone that doesn't have a not yet in their life is either lying or dead. There has to be a not yet. The second thing I want to tell you is a cute little story that again encapsulates this point in a nice little way. A child was once learning how to read, and here, if you know Hebrew, you know what I mean, and when he came to the Siddur, and he had the two yuds that were next to each other, so he read it as two yuds. He read the vowels that way, and the rabbi said, no, the two yuds together are God. You have to say God's name. And then he came to the end of the verse, and again, the way many Siddurim are printed, there's like a colon at the end, which looks like a yud on top of a yud. So he read it as God's name. So the rabbi said, no, that's a period. So the child asked his teacher, how come it is that the two yuds that are side by side are God, and the one on top of the other is a period? So the Rebbe gave him the following explanation. A yud is a yid, a Jew. When two yids stand side by side, when they walk with each other, when they support each other, that is when the divine presence comes into the world. Two yids side by side, that is God. When one yid is on top of another yid, when one steps on the other, when one looks down at the other, that is the end of the verse. The Torah cannot go any further. That is the end. So the message is that we do have to be the two yids side by side, and that is when God comes into our lives. But if one yid looks down at the other in disparagement or even neglect or apathy, that is the end. The Torah is not going to go any further. The Zohar says very strikingly that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. It's a little bit of a question on that. There's actually only 325,000, but let's look at the Zohar for a second. There are 600,000 letters in the Torah, and there were 600,000 souls of the Jewish people who left Egypt. Therefore, that's the totality of the Jewish people symbolically. Each Jewish soul has a letter in the Torah that is their own. In fact, some say very, very beautifully that how do you explain the 600,000 discrepancy with the 325? Because, in a Kabbalistic way, the spaces between the letters are hidden letters. And that represents those Jews who have not yet found their connection to the Torah. And yet we know if a Sefer Torah misses any letter at all, the Sefer Torah is not complete. That unless we unite and help each other and learn from each other, unless we enable everyone to try to find their letter of the Sefer Torah, the Sefer Torah on which is written the destiny of the Jewish people, will by definition be defective and incomplete. And as we approach the holiday of Shavuos and the reacceptance of God's Torah, let us remember that without love of Israel, without connection to each other, there can be no Torah. Torah will be defective. Therefore, may God help us in this time of polarization to make the right choices, to look at each other with respect, with kavod, and with love, and in that way we will merit to bring the coming of the Mashiach. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to cut on our own. Afterwards, Rabbi Budowitz is going to take some questions and answers before we go on. Though I just want to mention that there's Rabbi Budowitz's inspiration. I can't leave it alone. I don't want it to just dissipate. So I
Rabbi, we see the reform movement in this country moving toward the traditions, and now in reverse, moving away from the traditions. Because of the vast movement, the reform movement, to officiate the marriage of homosexuals. I've discussed this with a Reform rabbi, and it's done on the basis of humanity, of love. Now, I understand what you say by respect and so on, and yet, is there any point that you look at some of the acts of the Reform movement or any other movement and say, what is going on here? It becomes virtually intolerable.
Well, no, I think you have a very, very good point.
Maybe you can repeat the question.
Yeah, the question that was raised is that the Reform movement in recent years has begun to legitimate many things that are really totally repugnant, abhorrent to the Jewish tradition, officiating at homosexual weddings and the like. It's one thing not to actively discriminate against gays. I think even Orthodox rabbis are supportive of not doing witch hunting, but on the other hand, do we sanctify and legitimate ceremonies? I think the answer, again, it's very, very difficult. I think the answer is very, very clear. We cannot take an I'm okay, you're okay attitude. We have to indicate that we consider these steps to be repugnant. On the other hand, I will tell you that there are masses, thousands and thousands of Reformed Jews who are interested in a tradition. They will not necessarily become Shomer Shabbos, who want to learn Torah. It's very, very important that we don't allow denominational labels to prevent us from interacting and exposing them to the teachings of the Torah. So I will differentiate between, you know, endorsing decisions that a movement makes and having to interact individually with Jews. For example, if you have neighbors who are not Shomer Shabbos, invite them to your house. You know, don't give them lectures about Shomer Shabbat, but just let them see, expose. I mean, people say even in the land of Israel, again, I don't want to make too much about throwing the rocks. I mean, it's a relatively small number. But if everyone who threw a rock would invite a non-Shomer Shabbos to their house just to experience a Shabbos, things would be, might be, I don't want to say would, might be very, very different. So I'm not talking about endorsing what the national councils do, but I'm talking about the one-to-one interactions. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I agree with everything you said, and the basis are the citations of the Torah and the Gemara and Perkei Avos and so forth.
Yeah.
And this is therefore, I think, very, very persuasive to a religiously oriented community.
Right.
What is the basis? How do you approach those, both here and in Israel, who seem to be disdainful of the Orthodox community or of anything smacking of Judaism? They sometimes don't seem to even care for the land. As far as they're concerned, Hebron could be Kansas City. How do you approach them? On what basis? Presumably, if you use a basis of Torah and Gemara, they'll say, well, you know, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
How do you convince them that they should accept or reach out a little bit and have kavod for the people who are in the observance community?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a very, very good question. Obviously, you know, I can prove points to people who believe in Torah by quoting the Torah. Those are not proofs to someone who doesn't believe in Torah. But I would suggest two things. I would suggest, number one, even people who are not very religiously observant, at the very least, do have a certain respect for tradition. So, for example, you show them statements in the Bible and the Talmud, they will not regard them as binding, but they will at the very least regard them as interesting and informative, and it's something they're willing to explore. For example, in many Reformed congregations, although they may not accept the divinity of the Torah, they are willing to see what the wisdom is. So very often, you can start shared educational programming without having a common theological premise. You don't have to agree in theology to begin to explore Jewish texts. My second point, that if, in a way, again, I put the burden on us, we do have more of a responsibility, if we live our lives as exemplars of loving, tolerant, accepting communities of individuals who genuinely strive to be holy, that will have an impact. People will look at us and say, if that is what Judaism is, I want to be a part of it. If we're not living our lives in a way that others look at us and say, that's what I want to do, then in a way there's something wrong with us. In other words, the concept of sanctification of God's name, and if you have faith in the power of the Torah, I think we have to believe that if we truly live up to these standards, it will have an influence on people. Now, maybe that's naive, but I think that is true. Yeah.
In Israel, there's been a movement, the Reform and the Conservative movement have been pushing to get more power in the religious sphere in Israel, under the banner of pluralism. Now, they've been, one of the projects that they want to institute is to have like a joint conversion institute where you have a cooperative program where Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox rabbis would participate in it, and eventually the conversion would be done under Orthodox auspices, but the educational process would be done through Reform and Conservative rabbis as well. and the chief rabbi in Israel rejected that proposal. And many people reacted by saying, well, the Orthodox are intolerant because they weren't willing to accept that proposal, which seems to be a proposal that involves cooperation. Now, the question is, are the masses interpreting it correctly? Is it a lack of tolerance, or would it be a question of sacrificing principle? Like you mentioned, that you have to be tolerant, but you can't sacrifice your principles. How would you interpret, what would be your take on what's going on in Israel?
You hit on a very, very difficult issue, and my views have even been published, and I've gotten a lot of criticism for them, are a little bit off the mainstream. I myself agree with the rabbinate's rejection of the Neman proposal for the following reason. It's very, very important that we don't do things that are pretenses, meaning to say, the concept of an Orthodox conversion does not just mean a conversion in which the rabbis who signed the certificate happen to be Orthodox. It's not a game like which rabbi signed the paper. An Orthodox conversion presupposes that the candidate for conversion has agreed to live in accordance with the halacha as defined by Orthodox tradition. Now, to have a circumstance where people, in other words, the idea was we don't ask too many questions. In other words, they'll go through this school and we'll sign the paper. That would render it a sham. And I think it's very, very important that we have to understand that if it is wrong for Orthodox, as it were, to impose their principles on conservative reform, it is equally wrong to force Orthodox people to compromise on what they regard as halakhic principles. So I am not at all in favor of a joint conversion school, and I don't think that its rejection is intolerant. Now, my own radical proposal is that I think the cause of religion is much more advanced by persuasion and education and not through governmental coercion or authority at all. I would be willing to let conservative conversions occur as conservative conversions, let reform conversions occur as reform conversions, let Orthodox conversions occur as Orthodox conversions. I am much happier with having the reform rabbinate do reform conversions than have Orthodox rabbis sign off on what is essentially a reform conversion. So the concept of separation of church and state, I think, has a great deal of wisdom, perhaps, even in a country like Israel, not because I believe that the state gets corrupted by religion, but I think it's the opposite dynamic. I think religion gets corrupted when it is overly involved in political power. So that's a bit controversial, and I'm certainly not speaking for anybody at all. It's just my own personal opinion. Yeah.
I heard you extol the virtue of Abraham Avinu.
Yeah.
So how do you correlate that with the fact that he sent out his own son to be murdered?
You're talking about Yitzchak? Yeah. Because he smiles the problem too. Well, you know, I tell you that Yitzchak is considered to be the extreme idea that when God gives you a command, you do it no matter what. However, I want to point out there's an aspect of the Akedah that people often ignore. People often look at the Akedah as the paradigmatic situation of total submission to the will of God, which it is. However, we shouldn't forget that God's final command to Abraham was not to slaughter Yitzchak. In effect, there's a double message in the Akedah. God tells Abraham, if I want you to kill your son, you got to be ready to do it. But I want you to know that's not the way I want you to serve me. Meaning, there is a message in the revocation of the Akedah order in which God is saying, I don't want you to sanctify my name by killing and destroying others. In fact, there's an interesting comment from the when the Hasidic movement was excommunicated back in the time of the Vilna Gaon, if you can go back the whole story there. So somebody brought the ban of excommunication to a great rabbi, Rabbi Raphael, the rabbi of Hamburg. And he was asked to sign it, and he was told, you have to sign this because an angel of God, the Vilna Gaon, that is like an angel of God, signed this proclamation. So he pointed out, well, you know, when God told Abraham to slaughter Yitzchak, it doesn't say an angel told him, it says God told him. But when the decree was annulled, it says Malach min HaShamayim. So he says, to slaughter a human being, to destroy a movement, Only God can give you the command for that. To save a movement, that can come from a malach as well. So, in the Arcadia, there is that double message. Sorry, did you want to tell me?
The point that you make, Rabbi, that the Reform rabbis should have Reform conversions and so on.
Yeah.
We have a tremendous problem in recognition of the offspring of people who are converted.
Yes.
Terrible problem.
Legal
as well as
religious. Listen, I understand that. The question becomes, what are our alternatives? The one thing I don't want to see, I do not want to see the dilution of an Orthodox conversion. I don't want to see someone that has three Orthodox rabbis signed on their gerus, in which I have to wonder whether this is valid. Now, in the United States, it's not the best situation, but in the United States, at least we have a situation where I know what I'm getting. As an Orthodox rabbi, I see conversions from many, many different sources. I know how to deal with them at this point. Now, maybe after a number of generations, it's not going to be so easy anymore. But at least at this point, it's a containable, manageable problem. And let me emphasize that any conversion can be changed. In other words, any Reform conversion can eventually get conservative or Orthodox. I just don't want to see the integrity of a halakhic conversion undermined by things like joint conversion panels. So I'm very, very uncomfortable with calling on Orthodox rabbis to dilute the definitions of halakhic conversions.
Today the situation in Israel is, according what you suggest, is that when you were converted in the United States by Reform rabbi, and you come to Israel, you are recognized as Israeli, you are deserved to ID, but you can't get married according to the Orthodox halacha.
That's correct.
So what happened is one who get converted by a Reform or conservative rabbi here in the United States or whatever around the world came to Israel and had to do the same procedure again.
Uh-huh.
In different way. It's not the same, of course. It's difficult and it's more demand and,
yeah,
and other things. And people get very angry and upset about this issue.
Yes.
That actually when they want to get married in Israel, they can't, and their children won't be recognized as a Jew. So this is the problem today that Israel are dealing with.
You know, it's a lot of problems, and again, some of my recommendations are very radical. I don't want to be a spokesperson. But you know, the Knesset is a secular body. The Knesset is not a religious body. And for purposes of the law of return, I don't really see that we have to fight that it has to be Giyur Kahalacha, because if somebody identifies with the Jewish people, you know, maybe in terms of the Knesset, maybe that should be sufficient. I'm not sure if the Knesset, most of whom are not Shabbat observing anyway, should be deciding, you know, who's a Jew and who's not a Jew. As long as the religious communities are free to have their ability to make their own determinations, I don't know if this has to become a political issue at the Knesset level. I know that it's controversial, but...
Yes, but the problem is the marriage. In Israel, the marriages are according to the halacha.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't have a civil marriage like here in the United States. I mean, they have... People have to find other...
I think the implication of my remarks, which again, I'm getting more radical than I thought, but the implication of my remarks is that perhaps for purposes of secular law, there could be the possibility of civil marriage. In other words, the Knesset kind of says, we're not in the business of imposing religion on people. That is the responsibility of the rabbis, the yeshivos, the outreach programs. And I think if you take it out of the political system, I think many Israelis would respond more positively. Because now it is perceived as a bickering for power struggles and control of money. So there are a lot of far-reaching implications, none of which I'm very happy with.
Yeah.
But what I see is, it's going to be increasingly difficult. It's Lahapka like South Africa. It's increasingly difficult for even a large minority to impose something on a majority. Something's going to have to give.
Yeah.
And I think if you get the state out of it, I think there'll be a lot more openness to religion.
So you're advocating a complete separation between church and state.
Well, not a complete separation, but the notion of... I'm in favor of the government supporting religious institutions. That not like America, but against any type of coercive idea that you can't do something unless you comply with a certain religious standard. I think that's that cannot survive.
Kashrut, all those issues, like the laws of raising chazir and things like that.
Well, you know, I don't know if you have to throw out everything. I mean, certain things are rooted in tradition, which are not very controversial. I don't think there's a big movement in Israel right now to legitimate pig farming.
Can't hear you. Could you
just... No, I'm just saying that I don't think there's a big movement in Israel to legitimate pig farming. I don't think that we have to monitor everything. But I think when it comes to individual decisions, who can I marry, who can I not marry, we may have come to a difficult juncture in the state's history where it's no longer the province of Knesset legislation to make that determination when it impacts on individuals. I say that with a lot of regret. On the other hand, I do find a certain support, even in the writings of the Chazon Ish, who was not a modern Orthodox or progressive, but in the great, great Gadol, the Chazon Ish, where the Chazon Ish really writes that in a time of Hester Panim, a time when God is concealed, a time when there's no prophecy, the way we expose people to God is by persuasion and ropes of love, chavalei avotos ava, and not through coercion. And therefore, I am afraid that the use of secular law to force people to behave a certain way. Now, I would differentiate. For example, closing streets on Shabbos is actually a legitimate and respectful accommodation, because after all, why should people have the right to drive through my neighborhoods? I mean, that's a question of impacting on somebody else. On the other hand, when it's a question of who can I marry, I'm not sure if the state should be in the business of imposing that. You know, so I think there are differences there. Street closings are actually much more defensible, I think, than some of the issues of conversion. Yes, sir.
Who would have married?
Who did marry?
Well,
put it that way. Well, Ruth had a conversion, though. I assume I know it was an Orthodox conversion. The only type you had in those days. Now, the truth is, many people cast aspersions on Ruth's conversion because she was a Moabite. And the Torah says Moabites cannot marry into the Jewish people, but the rabbinic interpretation was only the male and not the female. But many people raised questions. She did not have an easy time of it. And even after she married Boaz, and Boaz died that same night after he was with her, people considered to raise aspersions against her and against David HaMelech, etc. So there were a lot of questions even then, but we have to assume that this was a halakhically valid conversion. Are there any other comments or questions? Okay, well, thank you very much, and have a good day.